You're listening to a podcast from funnyinthemiddle.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this, we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on funnyinthemiddle.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking, on with the podcast.
All right then, hello, welcome to We Dig Music. I'm not Colin, I'm Ian.
Still.
And with me are my comrades and co-hosts, Tracy.
Hi.
Hi.
And Ian. No.
No.
And Colin.
Hello. This is really going to confuse the people on Twitter that can't tell the difference between my voice and your
voice,
isn't it?
Each episode we'll be talking about a different letter of the alphabet, bands beginning with them, like a band of headline level, and a band of support level. In case you weren't watching at home on your podcast,
yes,
I did explanatory hand gestures at that point. This week we are on P.
Yes, the letter P. So, which bands will we be talking about? Yes,
Porcupine Tree are the support band.
Yes.
Which I disagree with, but nevertheless, and Primal Scream are the headlining band.
Excellent. So,
let's get into it. Porcupine Tree.
Let's.
Colin, talk about Porcupine Tree.
Okay.
Hear the sound of music drifting in the aisles. Elevated Prozac stretching out for miles. Music of the future will not entertain. It's only meant to repress and neutralize your brain.
Porcupine Tree are an English progressive rock band formed in 1987, originally as a solo project by Stephen Wilson, prog legend. Although he wasn't yet then.
Yes, he was just Stephen Wilson.
He was just Stephen Wilson. He is now pretty much acknowledged as the king of prog rock.
Yes.
So it started out as a joke band,
really?
Initially. He actually started it out as a sort of parody kind of thing where
he did it progress from that?
He was pretending that it was a old
wind your neck interest.
Forgotten progressive rock band. And then it gained a bit of traction and he started getting a bit more serious and he added a few more band members later on and became a proper band with Richard Barbieri on keyboards, Colin Edwin on bass, and initially Chris Maitland on drums. But then he was replaced in 2002 by Gavin Harrison, who we mentioned in the King Crimson episode.
Absolute prog legend.
He is. There was also, from 2002 onwards, there was John Wesley on guitar.
Only live.
But for live stuff only. They have released quite a few albums. 11, I think. 10 studio albums. You can't tell that I'm doing Ian's technique of reading this off Wikipedia there.
Welcome to my world.
But they've also released nearly as many live albums as well. So they're very much a sort of live thing. But then since their final band as Porcupine Tree in 2009, Stephen Wilson has concentrated on his solo career.
Which basically sounds like a slightly more pretentious Porcupine Tree.
Some of the time, yeah. I mean, he varies it a bit. But as Porcupine Tree started out as a Stephen Wilson solo project...
It makes sense.
It makes sense for us to discuss both Stephen Wilson and Porcupine Tree today.
I'm going to mention Blackfield as well.
And well, his many projects, there's Bass Communion.
Yeah. I was going to... Did we put any Blackfield on the playlist?
No, I don't think
so. See, I was going to... No, that explains why Tracy's still so poisonous. She's seething over there. I was going to suggest listening to some Blackfeel so she could appreciate his more songwritery tendencies in a more concise form.
Well, this is the thing. I don't...
Oh, okay.
Now, Tracy's probably going to argue with this, but I... As prog rock goes, Porcupine Tree and Stephen Wilson, even at their most prog, are still very sort of melodic and song based.
Yeah, but it's just, it's not concise, is it? It's a bit.
It is
rambly.
Very melodic, he but it like... is rambly. I mean, most of the tracks that I listen to, they start off the first couple
mean
of minutes.
Most of the tracks. You didn't listen to all of the fucking tracks. You didn't do your fucking homework.
I skipped a little bit.
Oh, you motherfucker.
You're a disgrace.
You know, because he introduces melodies which are really beautiful for about 2 or 3 minutes, and then he just fucking goes off on one for the next 8.
But then he'll come back to those melodies.
Does
again.
He?
There's a lot
yeah.
of recurring, yeah. which if you'd have listened to it...
Possibly.
A lot of the tracks are journey.
But I mean, he doesn't ever wig out, to use your terminology.
Oh, he does.
No, he doesn't. Not in a way of... We're not talking like Lark's
not,
Tongues
not
and Aspics.
No, it's not
nearly.
Freeform noise.
Approaching. I mean,
His first solo album, That Grace of Drowning, is a little bit too...
That, yeah, that's got a bit, but we didn't put anything from that on the playlist, did we?
I mean,
so
do you know what?
Yeah, he totally did.
Oh, okay.
I need the podcast equivalent of an asterisk that you'd have in text, and every
what,
time...
like a small, like,
a little,
ball,
a little
like,
star.
That's really, really strong, that hangs around with a big guy called
Not
Obelix.
Asterisk.
Yeah, no, that was the right word. Asterisk.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You said asterisk.
Asterisk, yeah. So every time you say... prog rock, I want the podcast asterisk to, and then overdub that with
to say bye to artists,
and then overdub that with noodling nonsense.
No, no, this look right,
sweet.
Your fucking Twitter followers are so militant and they hate us talking about metal. You hate us talking about prog. I say fuck off. We talk about whatever the fuck we want.
We do.
If you don't like a band we're talking about, skip forward like 15 minutes.
In a bit.
Or kiss my balls. This is Ian. Signing off.
Just to clarify which one of us is talking.
Yes.
I'm Colin.
And I'm Ian.
Do you know, I was really excited when
I'm
I started...
usually more angry than Colin is.
I'm normally the one that likes nearly all of the bands except the Jesus and Mary Chain and a couple in the Christmas episode.
And yeah. You were wrong.
Anyway, what were you just saying?
I was really excited when I started reading around this about Porcupine Tree because of Richard Barberi.
Okay.
Because, of course, he was from Japan.
Yes.
The band, not the country.
Yes.
And I adore Japan. And they are prog. But they're the right side of prog for me. But actually, I found absolutely no influence in his keyboard playing. It may as well actually not have been him. I didn't feel any Japan-style influence.
Now, I don't know much Japan. I know that they're really, really well thought of. Like Tin Drums, a classic.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. I must listen to it at some point. But I always thought they were more synth pop than prog.
What's the lead singer of Japan called?
David Sylvian.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is on. He's on the Tweaker album.
Yes.
On the best track on the first Tweaker album, Linoleum.
Yeah.
I think you would love that song.
I will check
Which
that
is
out.
Connected to Nine Inch Nails.
Nine Inch Nails. Yes, because it's. Podboy, Chris Brenner.
Chris Brenner, that's it.
Right.
And he was a member of Nine Inch Nails at some point.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's noodling nonsense for me, most of this. It just feels like an unnecessary odyssey of late-era Floyd.
Now, all right, there is a lot of Floyd.
It's really Floyd.
Is it? Not all of it is, but some bits are. And he... Okay, Stephen Wilson... credits the moment that he got into music as being one Christmas where his parents both bought each other a record.
Yeah.
And his mum bought his dad Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd, and his dad bought his mum I Feel Love, I think it was, by Donna Summer. And he's basically, because it's prog,
yeah,
but it's always got a pop sensibility.
That's,
even
he's
though Tracy
really
doesn't see it.
Guy. Really
yeah.
poppy.
I mean, the latest album, he's gone even more pop, and he's getting a lot of stick for it.
There's a bunch of poppy stuff on Deadwing, even.
There's
like
poppy
Lazarus
stuff on everything.
Is the best song Coldplay haven't written.
Because like, it's Coldplay haven't written.
I know
the best
it's
song.
Like it's a super Coldplay-esque song, like really Coldplay, really
but in a good
keen,
way,
like piano-led ballad. But it's just fucking great instead of bollocks.
I didn't miss the pop side of him. There was the one song, one of his solo ones, "Hand Cannot Erase."
Yes.
The title track of that album, and yeah, that is definitely more pop, less prog.
Yeah. What? Because there's no nuclear in that.
And I liked that.
Good.
I liked that.
Okay.
What did you think of "Arriving Somewhere"?
Which is a Porcupine Tree song.
Let's see what my notes say. Yes. This one starts...
So this is arriving somewhere but not here.
It starts off nice. But I noticed, looking at it on the playlist, that it's 12 minutes long. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, right.
So wandered off.
Plenty of time for him to ruin this.
But he doesn't, though.
But he does. Because 4 minutes in, it just all goes wrong.
No, it doesn't.
He just starts
noodling.
I don't know. He starts noodling guitar. It's the guitar solo.
That's the dude from King Crimson.
It's Robert Fripp, isn't it?
Yeah, Robert Fripp.
Is it?
Yeah. Which explains a bit, actually.
But if you got pushed through that bit and then got to the middle bit, which is phenomenal, and then has a Michael Akerfeldt from Opeth guitar solo, which is one of the most achingly beautiful pieces of ethereal guitar playing.
Right.
There is a lot of etherealness. Definitely important.
I'm
going to make you listen to that solo directly after we finish this.
I think that's
so that you can be like,
speaking of Opeth, though, I went off and listened to the collaboration Steve Wilson did with him.
Oh, Storm Corrosion.
Storm Corrosion.
Bad idea.
Yeah, that's
Well, the thing is, I read around it, and when they got together and did that, they said they didn't want to end up being a metal prog supergroup.
Which it's
so
not.
They wanted to be more experimental. So I thought, oh, this could be good. This could be really beautiful. Yeah. And so I played a video on YouTube, Drag Ropes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the opening track on it.
The 2012 album.
Yeah.
And it did. In fact, I've got written down here, dark and ethereal.
Yep.
Beautiful, beautiful video.
All of Porcupine Tree's videos.
The video is puppets. Rod puppets and
Lassie
silhouettes.
Oil, is it? Video? The guy that does all of their videos, all of their visuals.
Yeah.
Like, even all the fucking documentaries that they've done around the albums are just beautifully filmed.
Yeah,
which is what happens when you hang out.
But the thing is, it started off all dark and ethereal, but after a few minutes, it just turned all prog opera.
Did you expect, though?
I've been into Stephen Wilson stuff for a while. I've been into Porcupine Tree for a while, but I'd not explored a lot of the supplemental kind of stuff. Yeah. So I listened to Storm Corrosion the other week, and it's, to my knowledge, the worst. In my opinion, it's the worst thing that either Stephen Wilson or Michael Akerfeldt have been involved in.
I don't think it's bad.
It's just boring.
Yeah, like I listened to it and I didn't hate it. I don't really carry any memories of it, which is not ideal. Like Bass Communion, it's all right.
That's ambient, so it's supposed to be not massively catchy and stuff. But yeah, I sort of got into them. It was kind of like a stepping stones from other bands kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think the first band, even though they're not sort of connecting in any way, but sonically in a similar sort of sound, for me, it kind of started with Paradise Lost. So Draconian Times by Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
From there, I got into Anathema.
Ah, there we go.
And then from Anathema...
I was just thinking, Paradise Lost really to Steve Wilson, I couldn't see
anything. Well, this is the way it works. From there, I got into Anathema, who were a lot more melodic and prog-based, but still are quite similar to Paradise Lost in some ways.
Yeah.
And then they evolved and became more... They're on the same label.
Case Cope?
Yeah, they're a Case Cope.
So from Anathema, I then got into Opeth.
Which is a good choice.
Which is an excellent idea. Always a good plan. The album that I got by them was Deliverance.
Which is a great
album. Which is produced by Stephen Wilson.
Yes, it is. He's produced...
He produced three or four of their records.
Yeah, that one, Ghost Reveries.
Blackwater Park, I think he produced.
Yes, I believe so.
But Deliverance is... I think they recorded Deliverance and Damnation at the same time.
Yeah.
And Damnation's got all the heavy stuff and Deliverance has got all the melodic stuff on it.
Yeah, it's got Windowpane on it, which is just one of the finest examples of that song.
I then heard Porcupine Tree after that and thought, this sounds exactly like Opeth.
But without the growls.
Just there aren't any growls on Damnation.
Yeah, yeah.
Which at that point, I only knew a edit version of The Drapery Falls.
Yeah.
Which cuts out before the growly bits start. And that album.
Ah.
And I'd not got Damnation or any of the earlier albums yet, where it's got the, like, almost black metal-y type bits on there. But then, so I liked the bits that I'd heard of Porcupine Tree, but hadn't really massively explored it further.
Yeah.
Until years later, my brother-in-law, John, who is a massive prog fan.
Isn't he just?
you don't say.
And, he is, I think one of his favourite bands is Porcupine Tree and Stephen Wilson.
Yeah.
I was down the pub yesterday and mentioned that we were recording this episode today, Porcupine Tree, and the guy I was with, Joan, just went, I love Porcupine Tree.
People do. If people tend to like them.
I'd hardly heard of their name.
Well, this is another thing. They are one of the most successful bands that hardly anybody's heard of.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I got into Deadwing because I read a review that said something like it was the soundtrack to a film that Stephen Wilson had written but never done.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that sounds fucking pretentious as hell. I'm checking that out. Because I like that. And I listened to it and I'm like, this is fucking great. I need to listen to all of it. Like, The Incident, that's a fucking audacious thing. Because it's multiple tracks, but it's like a 53-minute song.
There's basically two discs, isn't it? And the first disc... It's split into different tracks, but they all flow into each other into a 53-minute long song cycle.
That song that you put on the playlist, Time Flies, was off The Incident, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I thought I liked that at the start. It was kind of all minor chord tension. Really liked it. Really atmospheric. But it just goes on.
It's called Time Flies,
and I thought, well, yeah, not when you're listening to this, it doesn't.
See, if I'd have put the entire of The Incident on, which I wanted to, because theoretically it's one piece, then you'd have been less happy.
I struggled, I mean, I did try.
We couldn't put Anaesthetise on there because Fear of a Blank Planet isn't on Spotify.
Which is annoying.
Which is about... It's amazing, but it's about 17 minutes long.
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, did you say you think he gets more proggy as he goes back to being a solo artist after the Porcupine Tree
No.
Is that when you said he gets more poppy?
His first solo album is really, like, insanely proggy. He's got Guthrie Govan on there and...
No, Guthrie Govan isn't on the
is
first.
Is he not on that one?
No, Guthrie Govan is on...
But there's fucking flutes on it and stuff, isn't there? There's like...
Hold on. Are you thinking of the first solo album?
Go
or
Jethro.
Are you thinking of A Raven... Return to Sing.
No. Grace of Drowning. What I'm thinking.
Okay. Which is an album I don't know that well, but the flutes are all over.
There's Luminol.
I mean, yeah, that one from The Raven Luminol That Refused to Sing.
Really,
that was really noodling nonsense.
No, it's amazing. Shut up.
I mean,
that was the first one that came on. I was like, oh, Tracy's gonna fucking hate this.
Yeah.
I love it. But it takes long to get into the actual song.
But it does I only managed to listen to
10 of the 12 minutes of that track.
Well, that's the bit that I've had stuck in my head.
Yeah, because that's a great bit. But it is also the most King Crimson-y thing he's done.
It's the closest to classic prog, definitely, with all the flutes and mellotrons and stuff like
but
that.
But then there was some earlier stuff that, In Absentia...
Yes, which is 2002.
Yeah, and I like that more.
Blackest Eyes, wasn't it?
Blackest Eyes. The vocals on that one, he kind of had like a slight vibrato on his voice, and it reminded me of someone, and I couldn't quite think who, but I really liked it. And it's kind of got like a slightly heavier rock riff in it.
Porcupine Tree got more metal as they went on.
Yeah,
really.
If you listen to the middle of Arriving Somewhere, there's a fucking great riff in there.
But
he's got riffs for days when he does it.
Going back to what we were saying.
When he's not whittling.
Yeah, like when he rolls out a riff, you're like, motherfucker, that was good. Like, you look like a geography teacher, but that is a fucking riff. He does, right?
Yeah, definitely.
He is not cool. I love Steve.
He's a prog musician, of course he's not cool.
Yeah, he just looks like he should be like...
But going back to what we were saying before about him being one of the most successful... British musicians that people haven't heard of.
Yeah.
What Ian said at the start is actually right. Technically, arguably, we have got the bands the wrong way around today. Because Primal Scream, even though they have a...
Jesus, Tracy, stop it. Technology is not your thing.
Right.
It's not.
Sorry, I just spent 30 seconds watching Tracy just swipe try randomly at an iPad to try and unlock it and then give up.
So, yeah, what I was just saying before I was rudely interrupted, Primal Scream have a bigger sort of public persona.
Yeah, and they've like headline festivals.
My mum's heard of them and that kind of thing. But even at their peak, they were only playing the same sort of size venues as Stephen Wilson is playing now, and they weren't selling them out. Stephen Wilson is selling out large venues like the Albert Hall.
And he's putting on fucking Primal Scream shows as well. Like, I'm going to say his shows piss on Primal Scream shows, because he's doing videos that are all tied into the music, 5.1 surround sound gigs.
Yeah.
No one's, like, I hate
the
to say
who
it,
did it
the
sort who, of.
But I reckon he was the one that, well, other than Quadrophenia, I reckon he was one of the ones that really did prolific. Like, he took it on a whole
tour. I've got a great Quadrophenia story.
Well, let's save that
tangent with in a sec.
Enter Shikari did a 5.1 surround on their last tour,
yeah,
which was hilarious because there was a bit where they had crowd vocals coming from the back of the PA system, like the rear bit.
Okay.
And I looked around like, fucking hell, there's a lot of people. No, those are empty seats and a PA stand with fucking vocals. You fucking con artists. You fucking con artists.
Whereas sound at a Primal Scream gig is really quite rubbish sometimes.
Yes, but let's save that for in a bit.
Yeah.
We'll talk about them later. But, I mean, he gets some absolutely amazing musicians working with him. I mean, we've already mentioned Guthrie Govan. Let's mention Guthrie again, because he is... looks like Cat Weasel. Fucking plays amazing.
Next time his band, the Aristocrats, play, we should go.
Definitely.
Like,
Tracy would love that. Let's take Tracy.
Okay.
Right, the thing is, it is, like, it's the most noodly thing you will ever fucking see.
Well,
like, it's...
So, let's take Tracy against her will.
Shortly after I started seeing...
I will heckle.
You won't, because they're hilarious when they talk. Like, you can't hate him. Like, he is such a nice guy. Like, he starts talking, you're like, you're fucking off. You are so weird. I'm fucking enjoying... Like, the dialogue in between songs and the stories about the songs are way better than...
He pops up in some really weird places as well.
Yeah, because he's Dizzy Rascal's...
He played guitarist. Dizzy Rascal, and he was also in The Artful Dodger. He was their live guitarist.
I love Guthrie.
Yeah, he's great. And one of my favourite things I found out about him when I've been doing research is he had his own band, which had the utterly terrible name Erotic Cakes.
Erotic Cakes, that's amazing.
There was a break-in at their record company's warehouse, office, and 1,000 copies of their album was stolen.
and the
record company put out a statement saying, if the thieves can sell them, then we'll give them a job.
He's super talented, but god damn, he's never going to be successful on his own terms because he's just too fucking obscure.
He's very strange, but he's an amazing guitarist.
Such a good guitarist.
Didn't you go see Hans Zimmer? Wasn't he playing guitar with Hans Zimmer as well?
He was playing guitar with Hans Zimmer.
So Hans Zimmer, amazing soundtrack composer. And Guthrie's in his band as well.
That was, without a shadow of a doubt, one of the more pretentious things that has ever happened to me. I was at the gig, and I heard this solo, and I'm like, sounds like Guthrie. And then he went, and on guitar, Guthrie comes, like, no! I'm at the back of the fucking Arena Birmingham.
Yeah.
There are no screens. I should not be able to do that.
Yeah.
That's
but
cool.
He is quite distinctive, but he comes out with some amazingly beautiful melodies.
Yeah.
That 3 years older on How Can I Raise, the sort of main guitar melody on that is one of the most beautiful lead guitar parts.
Yeah.
I don't that often sit there and go, I want to work out that solo.
Do you know,
that's one that I have.
That was the first song I listened to
when
researching for this. And it really threw me because it started and it all was kind of like a bit 80s sounding, I thought, to begin with, the keyboardy opening.
Synth wash sort of opening.
Yeah. And then it kind of went really Floyd, very Floyd indeed. And so I was thinking 70s. And then I looked at the year and it's like 2015. Really? Yeah, it threw me.
Hand Cannot Erase was my favourite album of 2015, and it's still my favourite album of the last few years. It's absolutely amazing, and it's the whole album, with it being prog, it's a concept album, and it's,
yeah, everything sounded very concept-y.
Well, the story of it is absolutely fucking heartbreaking. It's a true story. There was a woman called Joyce Carol Vincent who,
okay,
she basically lived in a flat in London and died without anybody noticing, and she was dead in her flat for 3 years. And she was a popular sort of woman. She got friends, she got family. And she essentially basically disappeared. And nobody knew that she'd gone. And it wasn't... They don't know for definite what she died of, but it seemed like most likely natural causes.
Yeah. God, that is
heartbreaking. And she was surrounded by Christmas presents for her family that she was wrapping. So she was going to reconnect with them most likely. But the whole album is based around that, and it just gives it that much extra depth when you know sort of the story that it's based on. There's a documentary.
That almost makes me want to go back and listen.
No, it's seriously. When you know the story, it makes the album so much more poignant,
definitely,
sort of thing. And there's a documentary which inspired Stephen Wilson to write it, which he saw, called Dreams of a Life, which I actually watched last night.
Yeah.
It's on Netflix. And it's harrowing, but it's really interesting how it can like happen, because you'd think that somebody that just disappears and dies, you're thinking like, oh, it's an old, like, you know, bag lady type thing, and she was like about 40-ish and popular, attractive. In her life, this woman had like met Nelson Mandela and Stevie Wonder and people like that, and you know, but yeah, that just gives it so much extra depth.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful, absolutely staggeringly beautiful piece of work, the album is, as well.
It really is, yeah.
But that's put everyone on a downer.
Yeah, I know. So, I'm going to cry now.
Also, so to cheer everybody back up, Stephen Wilson is the only musician I can think of that connects Kajagoogoo, Opeth, Echo and the Bunnymen and Rainbow.
Wow.
What?
Because he's worked with musicians from all of those bands. Like, his current bass player is Nick Beggs.
Really?
From Kajagoogoo, who is now a prog bass player with a fucking Chapman stick.
My God.
So, too shy. Now too prog.
He was probably always awesome.
Oh, yeah.
That's the thing. Like,
he would, he's a talented musician.
Yeah, loads of really fucking awesome. Like, Zachtrick.
Oh, yeah.
That band, right? The first time I saw him, that guitarist, was playing for Bruce Dickinson.
Yeah.
Then he played for Gunn. He's the guitarist that played the solo on Word Up by Gunn. And then he was Robbie Williams' live guitarist.
Yes.
But I've forgotten his name.
Is it Guy someone?
No, that's the bass player.
Oh, so, yeah. Yeah.
But, like, fucking phenomenal guitarists. Like, Zachtrick are like a pop prog band.
Yes.
They're, like, all dressed up in makeup.
I don't think they still exist, but about 15 years ago, they used to tour around all the sort of, like, Toilet Circuit, Leicester, Charlotte.
Yeah, like they'd have two drummers.
Rougey,
like,
Red Rose Theatre kind of venues.
And they were phenomenal. Fucking phenomenal.
Yeah. I'm fairly certain I saw them once.
Yeah, I think we were at the same gig.
Yes. Yeah, we went. Was it Rougey we saw?
Yeah.
Cool.
Chris Dale. No, that was the bass player. I can't remember his name. Chris Dale's a fucking great bass player as well, though.
So Guy wasn't the bass player then?
No, he wasn't. But he wasn't the guitarist.
No. But it's Zachtrick, and people probably don't remember necessarily anyway. Another interesting musician that they had on Hand Cannot Erase.
Yeah.
There's one of the songs on there. There is a children's choir.
Yeah.
Sort of young boys choir sort of thing, and there's a soloist who sings this like melody line. Who was Tony Blair's son?
Wow.
Really?
So, Stephen Wilson was telling a story when he was touring that album, just sort of between songs, about the recording of that bit. And apparently they'd got him in the sort of studios, like, so he was in the booth, they were all in the mixing desk.
Yeah.
And they'd got the desk so they could press the button to speak to him and then, like, mute it when they'd finished. So they were pressing the button going, yep, that's really good. Sing it like that. Just try it one more take. Switch the button off. And your dad's a war criminal. So, I like Stephen Wilson and Porcupine Tree.
Also.
Ian does. Tracy, not so much.
I know. I feel we've brought you round a little bit now, though.
You have a little.
Hand cannot erase. If you can get past the fact that, yes, there are solos and stuff, and they're technically difficult to play,
yeah,
but they're still fucking melodic.
I don't think I could listen to that solo album, The Raven That Refused to Sing, though.
Raven That Refused to Sing is beautiful.
It is, but the Raven, yes, there is a lot more jazz influence.
When I listened to The Watchmaker, I entirely gave up at that point,
what?
Sorry.
The Watchmaker's beautiful, though.
But we think that
The Watchmaker made me cry. I listened to it on the way to work, and I was in a really bad mood, and then I listened to that, and I was like, oh, God.
No, I think I started off in a good mood when I at the beginning of this.
Made Tracy cry as well, but in a completely different way.
Yeah. I have to be careful what I listen to on the walk. Actually, I don't now, because I like my job, but I used to have to.
New job, work.
By the time you hear this, I'll have had the job for ages.
Cool.
Or I may have failed my probation and have another job. Who knows?
That's, yeah.
Let's hope not, though.
I think that's unlikely.
Yeah.
So, shall we talk about Primal Scream now to give Tracy a chance at being positive?
Yes, and me a chance at not being positive.
Tracy, tell us about Primal Scream. Footnote, there's an appendixy bit.
AKA, Tracy was wrong.
Yeah. What just happened, Tracy?
You just played me the most beautiful song by Porcupine Tree.
Lazarus from Deadwing.
And I swooned. It was utterly, utterly beautiful.
Yep.
And I'm sorry.
And you're going to listen to some Blackfield now as well, aren't you? Right.
I am. It was really lovely. But you know, it wasn't my fault that I went off and listened to the Opeth collaboration rather than the Blackfields thing.
No.
Because I didn't know that the Opeth one was bollocks.
Yeah, no, and
we just assumed that you would just get bored of listening to Porcupine Tree halfway into it and just listen to the band that you knew all week, because that's what you do.
Yeah.
Just like I only listen to it 10 minutes before you arrive. We've got types.
Yeah.
Colin really researches things.
Yeah.
You write a bunch of notes.
Tracy really, really, really researches stuff that she already knows, like the PJ Harvey one, where she listened to every single PJ Harvey album about a week each.
And I brutally fly by the seat of my pants and have really, really contentious and abrasive opinions about things. This is just what we do. Welcome
Excellent.
To We Dig Music.
So, on that note, let's now talk about Primal Scream.
Yeah, let's do that.
Scream are an alternative rock band from Glasgow. They were formed in 1982 when Bobby was still a mere pup and still drummer in the Jesus and Mary Chain. He left the Mary Chain
Was he about 15 at the time?
Yeah, 15, 16. And he left Mary Chain in 85 to concentrate on Primal Scream. He was basically given an ultimatum by Jim Reid. Either stay, because he was doing both bands, alternating between Primal Scream and Jesus and Mary Chain, and he was given an ultimatum and said, you're either going to concentrate on the Mary Chain or you're going to fuck off. So he fucked off.
Back in the day when you could actually have a drummer that was just in one band.
Yeah.
Which is not a thing that happens anymore.
So the original lineup included, obviously, Bobby Gillespie on vocals, Martin St. John on tambourine. He was a really fucking important...
Was he their drug dealer like Bez?
Yeah, come on.
No, he really was. Just the tambourine player.
Liam Gallagher can play tambourine efficiently and sing.
I don't know if Bobby Gillespie can play tambourine and sing, to be fair. Sorry, carry on.
Jim Beatty on guitar, Robert Throb Young on bass, and
why not Throbert? Why not fucking Throbert?
He was called that sometimes, I believe, but and a drummer I don't remember.
I didn't look that far on Wikipedia, you mean?
There were too many of them. The lineup changed every 5 minutes in the early days. I mean, after the first album, the founding member, Jim Beatty, left. Some strife after the first album, not doing as well as he'd expected. And Andrew Innes, who was an older friend of Gillespie's, joined.
And he's still
on guitar,
there,
yes. Young moved from bass to guitar. They got another bass player and a drummer who I don't recall either. But basically, Gillespie, Young, and Innes—that's the core of the band I remember. Yeah. So they were initially signed to Creation by Alan McGee,
who went to school with.
Yeah, he'd
Bobby
known
Gillespie.
Bobby since he was like 15, 16. And
nepotism.
And the B-side to their second single, Velocity Girl, was included on the now famous NME compilation tape, C86.
Right.
And that led them to be associated with the other bands of that movement. But Gillespie hated that because he thought all the other bands basically couldn't play their instruments or write songs.
Which is fucking ironic coming from Bobby Gillespie.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I quite like the guy, but that's fucking ironic.
Indeed.
What other bands are these?
Other stuff on C86, so there's the Bodines,
the Pastels on there?
Yes, there's a Pastels track on there.
Tallulah Gosh.
Tallulah Gosh. There's a Stump track on there.
So many bands I either haven't heard of or don't give a fuck
it's
about.
It's basically...
The Wedding Present.
It was mid-80s twee indie pop. Really, really sort of thin sounding, jangly guitar kind of thing. It's not going to be your cup of tea, mate.
Sounds like wank. Except I like wank.
Whereas I think it's heaven, utter heaven. So they released their first single on Creation in 85, and their first album, Sonic Flower Groove, in 87.
Sonic Flower Groove.
Yeah, and at that point... and at that point, they were all jangly, Byrdesian pop. And it was
which is exactly
beautiful.
Your kind of thing, isn't
completely
it?
Completely my thing.
When I was listening to Sonic Flower Groove yesterday, and it really reminded me of... Have you got the Children of Nuggets box set?
Yes, I do.
I was going to say, that is
of course I
the
do.
Most Tracy thing in the world. So, you know, it sounded like Beavis Frondue to Stratosphere. That
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Didn't sound like the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, no.
No.
Didn't have a yelpy woman and weird post-punk guitar.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no.
Yeah. Carry on.
But then they kind of went and had a bit of an image change from the first album to the second one. The second one in 89, their self-titled album, Primal Scream, they just went Rolling Stones pastiche.
Yeah. Was that one?
Total Rolling Stones.
No,
that's much
later.
That's their
but
next
that's
Rolling Stones
very
phase.
Much Rolling Stones.
They've come back to the Rolling Stones pastiche over and over again over the years. That's pretty much, I would say that's probably their default setting.
That and sort of rumblings of MC5 and Stooges.
Rumblings of MC5. Teenage Head.
Give me Teenage Head.
Which is Kick Out the Jams. That's
totally.
Not just rumblings of MC Pop. That's
it is
them
MC
playing
Five.
A fucking cover of it and changing the words and the title.
Yeah, what did I write down? Gimme Teenage Head, Primal Scream to MC5 mixed with the Stooges.
It's not even that much Stooges in there. It's the same fucking riff.
I fucking love that song, though.
This like Love Removal Machine.
A little bit.
No, like, because Love Removal Machine is shit.
Fuck off. Fuck off. I wasn't even predisposed to Primal Scream before you said Love Removal Machine was shit. Fuck off.
But then their third album, they change again. Screamadelica in 91. They were introduced to Raves by Alan McGee.
That's the one with the Loaded.
Loaded.
See, I like that.
Moving on up.
Well,
not the M People song.
So, late 80s, Alan McGee introduces Bobby Gillespie to rave culture. Didn't think he'd like it to begin
have some
with.
Drugs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Almost certainly.
Exactly. And they went to a rave.
Although, hold on, this is Alan McGee and Bobby Gillespie, so I don't think it was here, have some drugs. It was probably here, have some different drugs
different
than the ones we've been on for years.
And they.
I've had to fend these new drugs. Would you like to try them? Let's go to a rave.
And they met Andy Weatherall.
Was it
that should ring a bell, but it doesn't.
Andy Weatherall was a genius DJ and producer from that era. He essentially made Primal Scream what they were.
Ah.
He's the one that remixed Losing More Than I'll Ever Have
to turn
it into Loaded.
Right.
So basically what had happened with that was Andrew Weatherall was a journalist at the NME at the time. Primal Scream were not getting any press at all. They were seen as a joke. People were, particularly from their second album, where they were wearing all these leather jackets and stuff.
Yeah, leather pants.
Which was not cool in the late 80s at all. People were just like, what the fuck is going on here? And they were just
seen... Yeah, Bobby wears your spotty shirt, got on.
They were just seen as just a complete joke.
Uh-huh.
And then... So the guy that was trying to get the press for them,
yeah,
basically phoned up the NME, absolutely begging them. Weatherall had been to one of their gigs already and really enjoyed it, and Bobby Gillespie liked his hair because it looked like Mark Boland. So
reason enough.
Yeah, basically. So this press guy from Creation Records phoned up the NME editor, absolutely begging, almost crying on the phone, saying, Alan McGee said he'll sack me if I don't get some press for Primal Scream. So she said, right, okay, let's send Andy Weatherall down to go and review the gig. So he went down, gave them a really amazingly positive review, saying it was the best gig he's ever seen and all this kind of thing. So they asked him to remix, because he was a DJ as well.
Yeah, because he did it for his DJ show, his radio show.
He'd never done any producing or remixing before. But as a DJ, he knew what people responded to in the clubs.
Yeah.
So they gave him I'm Losing All That I'll Ever Have, which was that they'd actually recorded it to a click track, which they hadn't done with any of their other stuff. So none of their earlier stuff could have been remixed other than that.
Right.
So they gave him that, and he basically took the bass line from the end of the song and made it into it, and a couple of bits of Bobby Gillespie's vocals, and made it into a completely new track. And it was a hit.
And it was amazing.
Could you do a remix of this? Yep. I'm using this bit and this tiny little bit. And then throwing all this new shit. I'd be so bummed.
Oh, he really was, though. Bobby Gillespie fucking hated it because they had to do it on Top of the Pops and he just felt entirely redundant. He's got an in it. That's it. That's it.
He's got even less in Don't Fight It, Feel It.
Well, that's true, because that's all just Denise.
They should Johnson. Have fired the tambourine player and given him a...
Martin St. John had long gone.
But Don't Fight It, Feel It is their most acid house track of that era.
Total happy house.
So that's on Screamadelica as well. And I saw the other day, I saw them performing, it was a bit of footage of them performing on, I think it was The Late Show or something like that. And Bobby Gillespie, because he has nothing to do on that song, was just standing there doing the worst dancing I've ever seen in my life.
I love Bobby Gillespie's dancing.
Fucking hilarious.
No, I love his dancing.
It was really, really, really funny. But they're another band where they're, like our good friend Optimus Bowie, they're musical chameleons. They change their style so often.
Yeah.
Slight.
They've done a lot.
Slight. Oh, what's that word? You know, when we talk about other things.
Tangents.
I'm usually so good with words. My words are failing me today. But, do you think this whole thing, that guy, Weatherall, remixing shit, do you think that's why Fatboy Slim happened? Because he remixed a lot of people as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Motherfucker. the remix of Tequila. I don't like the original song. I don't like the remix, but it became fucking massive, didn't it?
Yeah.
And it's all him. What else did he do as well?
Oh, he did loads. He did...
Brimful of Asher.
I fucking hate that song too.
I quite like some Fatboy Slim stuff.
I know, but I love the original version of Brimful of Asher, though.
For a while, in 97, to get a hit, you had to get Norman Cook to remix your record.
Yeah.
It's the only way for it to become Happy Hour again.
Yeah.
But Andy Weatherall... Andy Weatherall, if you listen to the first Orb album, Adventures Beyond the Ultra World, that's Andy Weatherall. And that album, in fact, was released the same year as Screamadelica. I mean, that Screamadelica, Adventures Beyond the Ultraworld, Loveless, and Teenage Fanclub's Bandwagon-esque is my soundtrack to 1991.
Hold on. It's your soundtrack to 1991. 1992, 1993, 1994,
yeah, I was
and so
just
on.
Just about to say,
until 2018.
When I want to be doing homework for the fucking podcast.
Yeah, I want to live in that year for the rest of my life, basically.
I was nine.
I was slightly older than nine.
Yeah, my soundtrack in 1991 was mostly the theme tune to Maid Marian and Her Merry Men.
I think I was listening to
that. Was a good theme tune, though.
Fucking brilliant program.
91. No, it was pre-Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It was probably some bad shit. I think it was Utah Saints and stuff like that. The shame.
Utah Saints.
But, have a bit of a rave phase.
But I mean, Screamadelica basically, it just captured the tail end of British rave club culture. It won the first Mercury Music Prize. And it still gets included in the top 50 all-time albums on lots of lists.
Yeah. It is a good album. I don't think it necessarily flows very well.
No, it doesn't.
It sounds a bit like a compilation album because there's so many different producers on there.
Yeah.
But it's weird because they've got like a lot of the sort of Happy House stuff, and then there's a lot of Derby stuff, a lot of Come Down stuff.
Yeah.
But that sums up what was going on at the time anyway.
Yeah.
But
they were seen as such a joke at the time. I think it was Loaded that when they actually sort of released it and tried to get people to listen to it, they actually had to put it out as like an unmarked white label and sent it to all the record shops.
Going, wow.
We're not going to tell you
who
this is.
Yeah, I bet they would.
Just listen to it. Listened to it and went, this is really good. And they went, it's Primal Scream. Psych!
Yeah.
Tell us which one of these is. Is it Pepsi or another known brand? Oh, I don't know.
Because then they went off on. They toured that. They toured partly with the Orb. The first time I saw Screamadelica. After they just released it, when they did it live with the Orb in Birmingham.
Right.
Utterly mind-blowing. Amazing. But then they toured it over the period of maybe a year, 18 months, and the difference from the start to the finish, because I saw them again right near the tail end of the tour, after they'd done the European section, and a lot of drugs in between.
Yeah, of course.
And by the end of the tour...
It's what they do.
By the end of the tour, Gillespie didn't fucking know what song they were playing on stage.
Yeah, I've seen some Primal Scream gigs like that much later on.
And it really put me off. I just thought, like, fuck, I've paid for this.
Yeah.
It was a shambles.
See, years later is when I properly got into Primal Scream. I loved Rocks when that came out, and that was a couple of years after.
Yeah, like that song is cool. I like that song.
Was that 93?
Rocks, that's on...
It's on Give Out But
94,
Don't Give
Up. 94, yeah, Give Out But Don't 94. Give Up.
I had that on a compilation tape.
I had that. No, I didn't. I borrowed it off a mate of mine, which it was on the Donkey Kong Country free CD that came with the Super Nintendo.
Wow.
I can't even remember what else was on there, but that was definitely the first track on
it. Yeah, I had it on a guitar songs thing.
Yeah.
It might have had Supergrass or some shit on it like that, I don't know.
Was it Shine? I can't imagine.
Yeah, it was actually.
Was it?
Yeah.
All right.
I can't imagine you having any of the Shine.
No,
I got it for free.
Okay.
No, don't. That's not a thing. That's not me.
No, I was going to say.
I don't buy no fucking indie compilation bullshit.
Thing is, though, I mean, they had huge success with Screamadelica, and then they did Give Out But Don't Give Up in 94, and actually... They got really rubbish press for that again.
Well, yeah, it was kind of regressive, wasn't it?
It was.
If you're going to go from, you know, Loaded and stuff, that's what you sound like, and then you go, ah, actually, we sound like fucking
the third-rate Rolling Stones,
thanks.
Yeah.
And in fact, after...
It's a bit of a turnaround.
After Give Out, they...
Was it Vanishing Point next?
Yeah, after Give Out, they very nearly split, and what happened straight after that is Manny... Fresh from the split of the Stone Roses, joined Primal Scream, and it kind of revitalised them.
Yeah.
And then they started work on the Vanishing Point sessions.
And Vanishing Point is really
dubby.
Is that
the one with Kowalski on it?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
See, I like Kowalski.
I love that record. They did a dub remix album of it called Echo Deck, which is pretty good as well.
It got some.
I haven't listened to that, you know. I haven't listened to the remixes.
You know me. If you're going to put a dialogue sample at the start of a song, that's going to instantly make me go, oh, I'm listening.
Like, well, like Loaded then.
Well, it's exactly. Also
to a greater extent because it was good dialogue rather than.
Yeah. And it's a bit of dialogue from
Vanishing Point.
Yes. Yeah.
As well, which
Kowalski is.
Kowalski is the main character, and it's also. I can't remember if it's the same bit of dialogue or it's a really similar snippet of dialogue from Vanishing Point as well. Is also on Use Your Illusion 2 by Guns N' Roses.
Really?
But it's not actually. It's not a sample of it. It's Axl Rose quoting it.
Ah.
At the end of Breakdown, I think it is. It's ironic for a film about cars.
Mm.
So while with Screamadelica they'd like totally captured the moment with Andy Weatherall's remixing, and then they regressed with Give Out. With Vanishing Point, of course, they're train spotting.
Yeah.
The train spotting theme tune. And so they'd really like they were relevant again. They went mainstream with that.
They kind of accidentally
right place, right time.
They ride on people's coattails.
I've only just thought of this. They are the musical equivalent of Forrest Gump.
Like they're just tootling along, and then something good happens. They're like, yeah. Yes.
And some might call this bandwagon jumping.
Yeah, but at the same time,
the playlist, right? You can always tell it was a Stephen Wilson or Porcupine Tree song. It's cohesive.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
This is not fucking cohesive. The only thing that's cohesive is the shit vocals. Gillespie is not a good singer.
He's not a singer, no.
He's the weakest link, definitely, in the band, but you couldn't
like
have
music
always. No, yeah.
Even the stuff that was a bit fucking bollocks and like average Rolling Stones nonsense, I didn't mind. But his vocals are just
His enunciation is fucking terrible.
Yeah, you know me and people that can't actually say words properly.
Well, this is the thing.
That was
well,
a sentence.
He's Glaswegian.
There are
no excuse.
There are lots of Glaswegian people who sing, and you can hear exactly what they're singing. It's because he fucking mumbles. Yeah. Nothing to do with him being from Glasgow.
No, I mean, although there does seem to be a fairly large raft of Scottish vocalists that can't be fucking bothered on this podcast.
Oh, right. We're back at Arab Strap again, aren't
we? It's not just Arab Strap, is it? Not just Arab Strap. We've done someone else, and I'm sure they were also Scottish and probably bothered.
You didn't like King Creosote.
There we go.
Oh, that was it, yes.
There we go.
Yes, but he
But he's not Glaswegian. I mean, yeah, he's from Fife and does a...
I didn't say Glaswegian. I said Scottish.
Oh, okay.
Massively generalising.
Going back, as a result of Bobby Gillespie mumbling all the time, there are at least two songs of theirs where I've completely misheard lyrics.
Yeah.
I was absolutely sure for years that in Moving On Up, there was a lyric in there about getting
moving
right.
Out.
No,
getting.
That was Emplin.
No.
Getting.
Getting.
Is that say
what you're
the words.
Say,
say
getting.
The lyrics.
Getting.
Yeah, the lyric that I misheard was getting right out of Totnes.
Right.
Which is getting out of the darkness.
Do you know what?
Totnes is in fucking Devon. I thought it was in Scotland because.
But he doesn't sing that line.
Because
he's Johnson does.
He sings it as well.
Oh, okay. But I used to mishear that line as well. I used to think it said, "I'm getting down the doctors."
But then there's also in one of their later songs. On Country Girl, which was on Riot City Blues.
Oh, see, I actually like that.
No, I don't like that song, actually.
It's got brilliant mandolin solo.
I've started going off them by this point.
You already hated them by that point. Yeah, but the lyric that I misheard for years in that was, he says, "What can a poor boy do?" But it sounds like he's saying, "We can't afford Bob Dylan." Which seems likely.
Yeah.
Because Bob Dylan would be pretty fucking expensive to
hire. I know the line you're on about, but I can't hear that.
No, I can't hear that.
It was the only thing I heard for years.
See, this is what you get from growing up listening to like Sepultura and shouty stuff like that. Yeah. You can actually pick out what people say a lot more.
But I grew up listening to Sepultura.
Ah.
So, no, you can't.
Well,
admittedly, my hearing is shite.
There we go.
But anyway.
Sorry, carry on.
I was going to say, after Vanishing Point...
Carry on.
After Vanishing Point, one of the songs from that, and they had another remix, which took them another direction. So Kevin Shields did a remix of If They Move, Kill 'Em.
Kevin Shields was in the band at that point.
No, that was the first thing he did before he joined. And then he became a sort of more or less...
If they move Killam, he's on Exterminator, which he was in the band for.
If they move Killam is on Vanishing Point, and then they did an EP called If They Move Killam, which was Kevin Shields' mix of it, and that was before Exterminator. That was the first collaboration they did with Shields.
Because Exterminator is my era.
Exterminator is spelt with
no vowels at all.
They took
lots of that zero vowel bullshit, and I hate it.
I hate it.
But there was an interview in The Enemy at the time with Primal Scream, where he was comparing vowels to Hitler.
What?
I couldn't find the interview. I was desperately trying to find it online, but I do remember the quote, and he was basically saying that vowels are evil. They're like Hitler.
He did a lot of comparing stuff to Hitler quite controversially around that time. When they did a set at Glastonbury, he was doing Sieg Heil arm movements on their set at Glastonbury.
Yes, but he was off his fucking tree.
Well,
they did swastika eyes as well.
Yeah.
I don't think he was saying that swastika eyes are good, though.
Well, no, because you couldn't see through them.
I believe it was a protest song.
Yeah.
But that,
I mean, he got much more political.
That album is my Primal Scream album. I saw them at Leeds Festival in 2000, and it was fucking amazing. They were basically... It was like they were riding another wave of the current sort of dance music, so they were joining in with... the sort of Chemical Brothers Prodigy of sound.
But he wasn't as good as
I think
Chemical Brothers or Prodigy, even though Chemical Brothers did a remix.
Some of it's as good as Chemical Brothers, I reckon.
I didn't like it. I mean, I don't know.
You'd gone off them by that point.
Well, that's
it. It was my era.
I started going off them where just at the point you started really liking them.
I know, you're saying they're not as good as Prodigy, though, because we all know that Chemical Brothers are not as good as Prodigy.
Yeah.
Prodigy.
They're different things, though, aren't they? I mean, Chemical Brothers is your Chemical Brothers is much more your pop techno, and Prodigy is going much more towards a punk kind of thing.
I suppose. Well, it's got elements of it, but they're still pretty similar, I would say. But yeah, that set at Leeds Festival was absolutely amazing. And on that album, you've got Accelerator, which was them basically doing The Stooges meets Hawkwind. But it was the most distorted guitar sound in the entire fucking universe. But then there was also my favourite track on Exterminator, Blood Money, which Tracy's going to absolutely have hated. I know
really hated. I hated everything, from Pills onwards on that album. Yeah.
But you've got...
That run of tracks, Pills, Blood Money, Keep Your Dreams, Insect Royalty. Couldn't bear it.
But... Blood Money sounded like, and this is why you don't fucking like it, it sounded like Miles Davis at Bitches Brew Era trying to do a like 60s cop theme song.
Yeah, that sounds like the kind of thing that Tracy would
hate. It's not exactly the pastel, is it?
No, it just leaves me cold.
We've discovered this as in our homework past review from the previous band.
In between Porcupine Tree and Primal Scream,
we've discovered that because we played the solo from Windowpane by Opeth and said, put your hand up at the point where you switch off to Tracy, and it was the moment he bent a note, right? And the solo to Arrive in Somewhere But Not Here, it was when he did like a little jazz style rake. So the moment
technique,
the moment the guitarist displays some technique, Tracy's like, fuck this shit, I'm out. That's what happens, right? We now understand it, which is good. We can now start to quantify it and analyse it.
And we can now define what noodling means.
What noodling means to Tracy.
Yes. Yeah, not to anybody else in the world. See, the thing with Primal Scream is... they're the most patchy band in the world.
They really are, but
the playlist was all over the fucking shop, and there were bits where I thought, this is fucking wicked, I like this, I've never heard it before, Like Country Girl and Rocks, I've heard before. I'm well aware of them. I like them. But then, like Swastika Eyes, I knew it was them, but I hadn't heard it before, and I dug it. Kowalski, I hadn't heard before. I knew it was them. I dug it. Like, there's a lot of really good shit.
Yeah.
His vocals are still bollocks.
Yes,
he should just fuck off. But yeah, there's also a lot of absolute averageness.
Yeah.
Like, it's not bad. It's just.
Yeah.
I imagine their albums can be just really, really up and down. Like,
but their albums are, and their live shows as well. They're really inconsistent. I've seen them, I think, 3 times.
Yeah.
And 2 of those, they were really, really good. And 1 of them, they were just wank.
Yeah, I went to an all-nighter they did in Liverpool. It would have been years after Screamadelica,
I
think.
Imagine if they played all night, it would get a bit...
Well, they weren't meant to come on until about maybe midnight. and I think the worst thing about that afterwards, after they played, someone set the fire alarms off and everyone got evacuated. And so it was meant to go on till 2 in the morning, but actually most people...
That's not an all-nighter.
No, that's just a club night.
All right, a club night. And but most people fucked off after we all got evacuated.
You would, though, wouldn't you?
Like, well, you would.
Stand outside. Oh, I'm going home.
Yeah.
Kebab shop still open.
Yeah. But you know what? I saw them when they did the Screamadelica 25 Years thing.
Yes, I went to that in
Manchester. And it was a lot slicker than the last time I'd seen them do Screamadelica.
It would be.
Yeah, and they had some amazing visuals. But you know what? It didn't move me anymore.
See, that was the one of the good times that I saw them. The other good time, other than Leeds Festival, when they did the Exterminator tour, I saw them at Leamington Assembly, which was right at the tail end of them doing the 20 years of Screamadelica tour.
Yeah.
And they were fucking brilliant. Manny's bass was absolutely astounding, really loud, to the extent I wasn't feeling brilliant. And Higher Than the Sun, I was really, really looking forward to. I was right near the front. He started playing bass and I really needed to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
He had found the brown note.
Your particular brown note.
Yes. Yes, I've not got a particularly well stomach on. No, I'm going to have to go.
Should have just shook your fist at him in annoyance. You bastard! This is because of you!
But other than that, it was a really good show.
But after Exterminator, I don't know, I couldn't be arsed after that. And then they did go back and do their rock pastiche again with Riot City Blues.
Yeah. But you think they'd have learned by now. Like, the rock pastiche is not as successful.
Well, no, Rocks is one of their biggest singles.
Yeah.
But, like, in general, from what you've been telling me.
Yeah.
I mean, Country Girl was on Riot City Blues.
But I think a lot of their big fans they do tend to attract the kind of Oasis-y Stone Roses
This is
fan.
Kind of why I've always written them off. Because you know where I stand on that kind of thing. Like, I just... It just tends to attract some big fucking...
The mainstream, bollocks.
And no, it's nothing to do with being mainstream. It's the people
that do the pointy hand in the air pricks. Dance. You know how much I hate those cunts.
Yeah.
I know you said that we didn't use the C word enough. Right, that's what you said.
I didn't say we didn't use it enough. I said it... Ian had said earlier that we say it a lot, and I was saying I think we only did it in the Christmas episode. But let's start the new year as we mean to go on.
Yeah.
Well, calling Oasis fans really big,
cunts.
The finger waving in the air with the
finger waving cunts.
Fucking Weller haircutted.
Oh, fucking Weller. Let's move on before I get a fucking rant about that Lego hair.
Are you still on your fucking introduction?
No.
Okay.
No,
just checking.
No, it's just all of her notes look the same.
I'm not even reading from my notes anymore. Okay.
Put them down then.
Have we got much more to say?
No. But that's the bad thing, because they've got 3 more albums after that, and actually I've got nothing to say about them.
It doesn't have to be every single album.
But that's
they're
it,
fucking
but the thing
patchy
is,
as bollocks is what they are.
But the thing
when
is,
they're good,
I
they're
haven't
good.
Even
when they're
listened.
Bad, they're horrid.
Yeah. I haven't even listened to their last 3 albums.
Well, they
don't
might.
Know a single track
they
of them.
They might be really good.
They might be, but I can't be arsed.
I have listened to at least
Schrodinger's band.
I have listened to at least 2 of the last 3, and no, you're probably all right not bothering, to be honest. again, same with the earlier stuff, there's the odd one or two quite good track, but there's nothing stand out. For me, the last brilliant song that they did was Country Girl.
Wow, that was a while ago.
It was a while ago because it used to get played at the Skull Club in Tamworth, so it's well over 10 years ago.
I remember it being played at Skull Club, actually.
So,
and it was current then.
Yeah.
Stephen Wilson should have been the headline act then.
Yes.
Fuck you, Primal Scream.
I think we're pretty much done there.
I think so.
Yep.
So, next week, it's the... No, not next week. Next episode. It's every 2 weeks. I need to get that in my head.
Yes, you do.
Next episode is the letter Q. So, there aren't many bands that begin with Q.
No.
So, I bet you can guess at least one of them. We will be talking about...
I can't even divert away without giving away other things that we're going to talk about in later seasons. Like, this is bullshit.
Well, I don't think we've got don't think we've got Suzy Quattro planned.
We haven't.
No.
Or Quintessence.
I'd have preferred Suzy Quattro to what we are.
Anyway,
going to talk
about. Shut the fuck up and save that for the next episode. Next one,
yeah,
we're going
Tracy.
To speak about Queen and Queen Adrena.
Yes.
So
Queen Elizabeth II.
Queen Elizabeth II, her
Dub Reggae solo project.
On. Queen Elizabeth is actually a side project of Julian Cope.
Oh,
so we could have done that. It's a weird ambient electronic-y type thing that he's done.
That actually sounds interesting.
It's not as good as it sounds.
Well, no.
And I'm a Cope fan. But anyway, we've been Weeding Music. Bye!
Bye!
I don't buy no fucking indie compilation bullshit.